Leading Ideas Talks is brought to you by the Lewis Center for Church Leadership of Wesley Theological Seminary in Washington, D.C. Subscribe free to our weekly newsletter at www.churchleadership.com/leading ideas. How can we lead like Jesus? In this episode, thought leader Dr. Ken Blanchard shares insights with Lewis Center Director Douglas Poe about being a servant leader.
Welcome to Leading Ideas Talks, a podcast featuring thought leaders and innovative practitioners. I'm Douglas Poe, the director of the Lewis Center and your host for this talk. Joining me is Dr. Ken Blanchard, who many know as the co-author of The 1 Minute Manager. Today, however, we are discussing his co-authored book, Lead Like Jesus. Ken, thank you for joining us today, and we're grateful that you've made time for this podcast. And I just want to begin with giving you an opportunity to say a little bit about yourself and then have you talk a little bit about why it is, given your success and sort of secular leadership, that you decided to co-author a book based upon Jesus' leadership.
Well, we also have revised that, Doug. We have Lead Like Jesus Revisited. So it just came out a while back, so they might want to get the updated version. But I tell you, I was a latecomer to the Lord, and after the 1 Minute Manager came out, it was so successful, I was having trouble taking credit for it. And people said, well, why do you think it was so successful? And I don't know why I was saying it, but I said, I don't know, God must be involved. And my mother was praying for me. And all of a sudden, when I said that, I started getting invited to different things. So I got invited to the Hour of Power with Robert Shula in his heyday. And he interviewed me and he said, Ken, I love the 1 Minute Manager, but you know who's the greatest 1 Minute Manager of all time? I said, who's that? He said, Jesus. I said, really? He said, yeah, he was really clear on goals. Wasn't that your first secret 1 Minute goal setting? Yeah. And he said, and you and Tom Peters didn't invent management by wandering around. Jesus did. He wandered from one little village to another. If anybody showed any interest, he'd praise him, heal him. Isn't that your second secret 1 Minute praising? Yeah. And he said, and if people stepped out of line, he wasn't afraid to give him a 1 minute reprimand. He threw the money lenders out of the temple. Isn't that your third secret 1 minute reprimand? Yeah. He said, so he's the greatest servant leader of all time. I mean, 1 minute manager of all time. And so I went, wow, that's really interesting. And so I got interested in that and started inviting to meet people, like would I write a book with Norman Vincent Peale and all that. And in the process, I started to read the Gospels of Mark, you know, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and Acts. And I was just blown away because I realized that everything, Doug, I had ever taught about leadership, Jesus did with these 12 incompetent guys he hired. I mean, you wouldn't have hired that lot. And so
that is true.
So I just felt he was the greatest leadership role model of all time. And so I ended up starting a Lead Like Jesus ministry. It's now all over the world. We're not evangelizing. We're just saying, here's the greatest leadership role model of all time. And we feel if people realize what a great leadership role model he was, then they might be interested more about him. And so we're just sharing that. And it was interesting. John Ortberg did a session for me with me in Atlanta one time, and his church is in Northern California. And I said, John, why would you fly all the way across the country to tell people that Jesus is the greatest leadership role model of all time? And if you know John, he's a character. So he said to the audience, we had a couple of thousand at church, and we had satellite sessions all over the country. And he said, just to suppose that 21 or 2200 years ago, you were a gambler. Now, I know some of you don't like gambling, but just humor me. Who would you have bet your money on lasting, the Roman Empire and a Roman army, or a little Jewish rabbi with 12 incompetent followers? He said, isn't it interesting that 2,100 years later, we're still naming kids Jesus, Peter, Paul, and Mary, and we name our dogs Nero and Caesar? He said, I rest my case. So I got really interested in And Jesus is a great leader. And so that's where we ended up writing the who's written several books on leading like Jesus.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. And it was good to hear the connection between the One Minute Manager and Lead Like Jesus. And you sort of hinted at or started talking a little about servant leadership. And when you read the book, it's really clear that this idea of servant leadership is important to you in terms of how we are called to approach leadership. Can you say a little bit more about why you think servant leadership is so important and why you think, in many cases, particularly those who are in the secular world, don't really think of servant leadership maybe as the first way to go about being a good leader?
Well, I think, Doug, the world is in desperate need of a different leadership role model. We've seen what self-serving leaders have done in every sector of society, not only in our country, but around the world. But when I mention servant leadership, a lot of people think I'm talking about the inmates running the prison or trying to please everybody or some religious movement. But they don't understand there's two aspects of servant leadership. The first is the leadership aspect, which is about vision and direction and goals. Because leadership's about going somewhere. And that's the responsibility of the hierarchy, to make sure everybody is clear on what business you're in, where you're trying to accomplish, and what the values that are going to guide your behavior, and what the goals that you're trying to accomplish. And that's the leadership part of servant leadership. That doesn't mean that they shouldn't involve people in developing that, but it's their responsibility. So now once that's done, then you turn the pyramid upside down, and now you get to the servant part of servant leadership, and now the top management is at the bottom of the hierarchy. And who's at the top? The customer service people, because now they're empowered to bring their brains to work and make decisions that service the customers. And the reason why it's so powerful is that a lot of people don't realize that servant leadership's about both results, because there's vision, direction, and goals, and about relationships, which is how do you support your people and all. And John Maxwell, I just wrote a book called Servant Leadership in Action, where I got 44 people to write short articles on what they thought about servant leadership. You know, amazing group, including, you know, Brené Brown and Simon Sinek and Patrick Lencioni and Marshall Goldsmith and Frances Hesselbaum and Laurie Beth Jones and just all kinds of people. Dave Ramsey wrote an article and all. The reason they did is that they all really feel it's important. And John Maxwell, who wrote the foreword, said the only way to get great results and great human satisfaction is with servant leadership. That's when the focus is not on you, but the people that you're there to serve. So I think it's really pretty powerful.
Sticking with that theme for a little bit, and you talked about in chapter 20, you sort of described the pyramid that you just talked about, sort of the inverse of where the leaders are there at the bottom and the people who have to implement actually become the ones that are at the top. How can pastors think about adapting this model for ministry? Because I think sometimes even though Jesus is the model of leadership, or should be the model of leadership for the church, that we forget ourselves how important it is to empower those who are closest to the people to actually do the work of ministry. So how can pastors actually adapt this model that you're referencing of the people being the ones and not thinking the pastor has to be sort of the sole actor?
Well, I don't know if you know, Doug, but I was the interim pastor at our large Presbyterian church in San Diego for 14 months. And the presbytery wouldn't let me be called interim pastor. They said I had to be interim coach since I wasn't ordained. But one of the things I found out about churches is the reason why there's not a lot of leadership in churches. Doug, you try to give 45 speeches or more a year to the same audience. You don't have time to do any leadership. And so when I took over, we had two young youth pastors who were great, and an Egyptian pastor at an Arabic service, and we had an executive pastor that some people knew. and heard, but I had the five of us, every 5 weeks we preached. And as a result, we were really on our game when it came to our five-week time to preach. And the congregation really really loved it. And I think that we really need to do that. And the first time I preached, I said to the congregation, and we have four services, so we have to do it four times. I said, I hate to tell you, but you're not the customers. The customers are out there. There's the people that Jesus wanted us to serve, the widows and the orphans and the people that are hurting and all, that you're here to get a vision and a set of values that we think are important and support you for going out there and making a difference. And so a lot of them hadn't thought about it that way, but I think that's where the real action is, that why servant leadership is really appropriate. And if the pastor thinks that they got to do all the sermons and all, it's amazing. Like our presbytery and our new pastor, I think, said he's got to do like 45 or so, I don't know how many sermons a year. That's the stupidest thing I've ever heard. Why doesn't he let some other people do it, you know? And the presbytery was really glad to get rid of me.
Well, it sounds like, though, you had an impact on helping to shape sort of how the church rethought the way it should approach leadership.
Yes, I think so. And it's really all about what we can do out in the community. It's not just a social club, but in some places that's what it's become.
I want to delve a little bit more into the book. You discuss sort of four domains of leading like Jesus, is I think the language you use: heart, head, hands, and habits. And this sort of connects with the servant leadership. You name the heart as really critical to making sure that you don't become a self-serving leader. Can you talk a little bit more about why the heart is so critical to sort of helping us to look in the mirror, make sure we're not being self-serving?
Well, I think the heart is all about character. It's all about asking that question, are you here to serve or be served? It's not an intellectual thing. And I think people have to really look into their heart. And a lot of times when I'm doing seminars and I say, how many of you would like to be known as self-serving leaders versus servant? Of course, nobody wants to raise their hand for self-serving. But the reality is that a lot of us, you know, it fall into that trap. And what we have to kind of do is look at our behavior. And is it, do we want everybody sucking up the hierarchy? I said you can always tell a self-serving leader, because if you got a problem and you talk to a frontline person, you're talking to a duck. You know, they go quack, quack. You know, I don't know, it's our policy, quack, quack. I just work here, quack, quack. Do you want to talk to my supervisor? Quack, 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 quack. You know, because they got to pass it up the hierarchy. Where if you have servant leadership operation, you're talking to eagles. They can soar above the crowd. They can bring their brains to work. And so that's what they really have to look in their heart. Am I creating a department where everybody's looking to me to make all the decisions and sucking up to me? Or are we really in this thing together? And I'm just a facilitator for these folks really accomplishing the vision and values that we've set.
And sticking with sort of this idea of values and vision, in chapter 18, you talk about staying on course, and that part of staying on course is staying true to the missions and the values. And as you know, since you they wouldn't call you pastor, but we'll go ahead and say the pastor of the congregation, that most congregations have a mission, but people interpret that mission differently. So how do you help people to be on the same page so they can stay on course? Because I've found one of the challenges is, you know, people may agree on what the mission statement is, but the way it gets lived out often is where you run into the challenge.
Well, to me, you know, I wrote a book called Full Steam Ahead with Jesse Stoner, who had been studying vision for over 20 years. And And there's three or four parts of a vision. One is, your mission. What business are you in? Then what's your picture of the future? What are we trying to accomplish? What are our values and what are our goals? What we found is that it's our values that drive our behavior. You want to say what business we are, and everybody needs to be able to say it, but you constantly need to manage by a set of values. And it's interesting, I talked to Max Dupree, who was a great Christian. He was the chairman of Herman Miller. And I said, what's your job as the head of this great company? And I think this is a big role of a pastor, too. He said, Ken, I have to be like a third grade teacher when it comes to vision and values and all. I have to say them over and over and over again till people get them right, right, right. And you just don't put them up on the wall and do that. They got to be lived there. And that's what's constantly has to be part of the thing. And so the pastor has to realize that they're the implementers of the vision and keep on keeping on the direction going where you want them to go.
Do you think that as health forward did you experience when you were the pastor that you needed a group to sort of buy in that can help you model what you're trying to get the others to do? Or how do you sort of take those steps to move people where they can sort of move in the direction you hope they'll go in terms of the vision and the mission?
Well, we pulled all of our ministry leaders and our people together as a kind of a team, and we met every week to say, okay, the first agenda item is what's happening in your area, what happened in your area since we last met that you're really proud of, that you'd like to share with us so we can applaud you, you know. So we gave people opportunity to share what was good. And then we would go around and say, what's happening in your area this next week between now and the next meeting that you've got some concerns about that you could use our help? And so we have people sharing. And we really work the values together as a team there, because we had the child's ministry, and we had the, you know, mission ministries, and we had, you know, the service ministry, Sunday services and all. And it was really good just to pull everybody together and say, you know, we're the ones that got to pull this thing off.
You sort of hinted at it a little bit, but I really love the phrase, and I think it was chapter 28, where you say, catch people doing something right.
Yes.
You know, that we tend to catch people, or we tend to comment when people do something wrong, but we don't tend to do it when, you know, people do something right. And what ideas can you share with listeners? How can we change our mindset to actually catch people doing something right?
Well, one of the things is to put that as the structure in your meeting. So we started off our meetings where people could share good things that happened in their part of the ministry since the last time, and we would all cheer them on. I think that's really important. Another thing that's really interesting is Gary Ridge is the president of WD-40, and I wrote a book with him called Helping People Win It at Work. And when he took over the presidency, he decided there would be no more mistakes at WD-40. All they were learning opportunities. And so the people would come in his office and, boy, say, Gary, boy, we have a learning opportunity yesterday, which means, you know, people kind of goofed up or something like that. But he'd say, oh, good, that's really, now what can we learn from that, you know? And creating an environment that people feel comfortable from sharing things that don't go wrong, but sharing them as a learning opportunity rather than, I was bad, I made a mistake. No, I guess we got a learning opportunity here. And so it's all what you're reinforcing there. And so I think that's the whole thing about catching people doing things right. And so say, God, I so appreciate you're bringing this learning opportunity to my attention. Now let's talk about how we could solve it, you know?
Yeah, and that makes sense. Do you think along with it that helps people actually then to become more innovative or be willing to experiment more, since they don't feel like if they make the slightest mistake, someone's going to sort of jump down their throat?
Yes, absolutely. You create an environment like that, people are willing to take risks, you know, and they might make a mistake here and then, but then they know it's a learning opportunity. So I think that's it's a fabulous concept.
The other thing that really sort of caught my eye is you talked about this analogy between carpenters and leaders. And, of course, you're referencing Jesus as a carpenter. But can you sort of share with listeners this analogy and how and why it's sort of important to think about leadership?
Well, we got interested in the whole aspect of, you know, where did Jesus learn how to be a leader? Well, we don't know much about Jesus from when he was about 12 years old, you know, and lost his parents in the temple, and when he all of a sudden appeared at age 33. But where did he learn about leadership? Well, the two references of him in the Bible before the Gospels is, isn't he the carpenter's son, or isn't he the carpenter? And so we thought, well, good. Well, maybe he learned leadership from his father as he learned the field of carpentry. So we got a group of carpenters together, and we said, what's the relationship between leadership and carpentry? You know, and they hadn't really thought about it before. And we kind of brainstormed with them, and it became really clear that a really good carpenter sees a finished product before they start, you know. A really good leader has a vision of where he's going before he gets underway. A really good carpenter has a sense of what are the various tools that he needs to work with various equipment, you know, and stuff like that. And good leaders have a sense of what different leadership styles that they need to use with you know, their people and all. We started to see a lot of interesting relationships. And then how do you become a carpenter? Well, you move from being a novice to a, you know, all the way over to being a master teacher. But over time, you move through four development levels, which is very consistent with our situational leadership stuff. And we were really interested in that journey, and so we talked about moving from a carp, from novice to an apprentice, to a journeyman to a master teacher, and how you learn different leadership styles by doing that. So as a novice, the leader's got to be an instructor. You know, basic information, what, how, where, and why to do things. And then when you get to be an apprentice, now the leader is all about development, instruction, and practice, and evaluation. And then they slowly move to journeyman, where they're now mentoring, because this person is someone who's able to work on his or her own, but they probably still need some mentoring, so it needs to still encourage them. And then finally, you get to the master, where you're really commissioning them. And so it was really interesting to see how Jesus moved his leadership style from the first commission. You got a couple of pages of directive behavior. He's telling him where to go, what to say, boom, 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 boom. And then you see over time, and then at the end of his ministry, end of Matthew, he says, go and make disciples of all nations and baptize them in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. And that's all the instruction he gives them, you know, because they now he felt that they had the capabilities, if they would do it, to be master teachers. Now he had to come back for one last visit just to reinforce that.
Right.
So we found a lot of interesting aspects of the carpentry and how he learned about leadership.
Do you think, as you were talking about that model, as we think about sort of discipleship today and the best way to help help people to become leaders, that we need to be more intentional about particularly apprenticing individuals or making sure that we can help to form them, that too often what happens is that folk are sort of left to figure things out on themselves.
Yes, the worst leadership style is to give people direction and then go quickly to a delegating leadership style and leave them alone until they screw up, and then you go back to a directing leadership style. We call that leave alone zap. It's kind of the what I call seagull management, you know, that seagull flies in, makes a lot of noise, dumps on everybody, and flies out. And no, you got to go from directing to coaching to supporting and then to delegating over time as you work with them to develop their skills to be a leader. So it's a journey. People don't just become leaders overnight. I think that's one of the problems in divinity schools. I don't think they teach pastors much about leadership. I think you end up learning a lot about, you know, the Bible and giving sermons and all. But am I wrong? Is there a lot of leadership training?
I think that you're right. Here at Wesley, part of the reason we started the Lewis Center for Leadership is to address that very issue. We require all students to take leadership classes because...
Oh, good. That's great.
Yeah, because you're right. You can come out of seminary and not really have taken any intentional leadership classes. You'll know some of the other stuff, but then how do you pull it all together where you actually become a leader is critically important.
Yes, I think that's really so key.
As we come near the end, I wanted to ask, throughout the book, you sort of talk about the ego, and I think this is a fine line, because most successful leaders have sort of a strong ego, but I think you're also right that there's a difference between self-confidence and egocentrism. You know, how do you... one, maybe differentiate between those two as a leader, and secondly, how do you walk that fine line to make sure that you want to be self-confident, but you don't want to become egocentric?
Yes, and I think that's really, I was just sitting in on a doctoral exam for Tracy Jones, Tremendous Jones's daughter, and she's been studying leadership efficacy, which is efficacy is more of a belief about your capabilities or skills to lead and to take a thing. And I think it's really important for people to know that if you get your ego in the way, the journey is all about you, not about the people you're there to lead. And because the point is, you're going to be nothing without them. That's why you got to get out of your own way. And sometimes it's hard for some people, you know, because they've been put in situations where they had to, you know, prove that they're better than everybody, you know. I think we have too much of that competition in schools and everything, in Little League and all that, where everybody's you pushing to be the best. And so you start to look at yourself compared to other people. I think what you got to teach people is I coached my son's basketball team and soccer teams when he was young, and I called all the parents together for a meeting and said, you might not want your kid to be, you know, being coached by me, because let me tell you what my goals are. Number one, I want to teach them skills, you know, so they get better basketball players, better soccer players. Second, I want to teach them about teamwork and cooperation. And third, I want them to have fun. And so, of course, one parent said, well, what about winning? I said, I want to tell you, if they improve their skills, they learn about teamwork and cooperation, they have fun, we're going to beat a lot of people. But that's not the goal. See, it's one of the things I found, Doug, out in the business world, is that the greatest organizations realize that their people are their number one customer. And if they take care of their people and they love on their people and empower their people and engage their people, then their people will go out of their way to take care of their customers. And because they do that, the customers become raving fans and become part of your sales force. And that takes care of the owners and the people that are worried about profit and all those kinds of things. So it's a matter of emphasis, I think.
Yeah, makes sense. Are there any last words related to the book that you would like to share with the audience?
Well, I would really love, because in the book, we're not, you know, trying to convert you. We're just trying to say, here was an incredible leadership role model. But he also, you know, his gospel was pretty powerful too. But it's a pretty great 1-2 punch. But I think if people look at him as a leader first, they're going to say, wow, that's really interesting. I hadn't thought about that. And then they might want to find out some things. As I said, as we go around the world, everybody loves Jesus with our ministry. They just don't like Christians. Because, you know, as I've said, we've got too many Pharisees in Christianity that are out judging people and all that kind of thing. Where, to me, Jesus said, you'll be known as my disciples by how you love each other. And then he said, judge not, or you shall be judged. And I think that's really an important part of being a leader, is this loving on your people and not sitting around with your arms folded, running around trying to catch them doing things wrong and judging them. Your job is to be the head cheerleader, to catch them doing things right and encourage them and help them be their best.
Leading Ideas Talks has been brought to you by Discovering God's Future for Your Church. This turnkey video toolkit helps your congregation discern and implement God's vision for your church's next faithful steps. Discovering God's Future for Your Church is available on download and DVD at churchleadership.com/shop. On our next episode of Leading Ideas Talks, Lewis Center Associate Director Ann Michael interviews Carolyn Helsel about her book, Anxious to Talk About It, written to help white Christians talk faithfully about racism.
Naming myself as a white person was often kind of the initial breakthrough that I needed to say that I'm not just a generic universal American that I'd grown up to see myself as. I was a racialized person, racialized as white, which gave me unfair advantages. And how can I, who don't experience racial discrimination, speak about this subject? And again, I saw not only in things that I was reading, but in conversations with people, that people of color were saying, you know, we don't want to be the constant educators for white people. We need white people to do their own work and to help other white people understand this subject, because we're tired of living with racism, you know, let alone having to do the additional hard work of dealing with white people's feelings and education around this subject.
Leading Ideas Talks is available on iTunes, the Google Play Store, and Stitcher. Subscribe today. Thank you for joining us. And don't forget to subscribe free to Leading Ideas at churchleadership.com/leadingideas.